This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is Ed Murphy, and today I will be reading the Friday TV listings, the obituaries, and the life section of USA Today for Hour 3. For Friday, April 26, I will start with TV listings. Friday evening, WLWT NBC 5 is WLWT 5 News at 7. 7:30 is Access Hollywood. 8 p.m. is Password. 9 p.m. is Dateline. 11 p.m. is WLWT 5 News at 11. 11:30 is The Tonight Show. WCPO ABC 9, 7 p.m. is 2024 NFL Draft to 11:30, where WCPO 9 News at 11. WKRC CBS, 7 p.m. is Inside Edition, 7:30 is Entertainment Tonight, 8 p.m. is SWAT, 9 p.m. is Fire Country, 10 p.m. is Blue Bloods, 11 p.m. is Local 12 News at 11, 11:30 is The Late Show. Sin CW 12.2, 7 p.m. is Family, 7:30 is Family, 8 p.m. is Penn and Teller Fool Us, 9 p.m. is 100 Days to Indy, 10 p.m. is the National Desk. 11 p.m. is the National Desk. WXIX Fox 19, 7 p.m. is Wheel of Fortune. 7:30 is Jeopardy. 8 p.m. is WWE Friday Night SmackDown. 10 p.m. is Fox 19 Now at 10. 11 is Fox 19 Now at 11. And 11:30 is Friends. WCET PBS 48, 7 p.m. is the PBS News Hour. 8 p.m. is Washington Week, 8:30 is Firing Line with Margaret, 9 p.m. is Jackie Robinson, 11 p.m. is Armapour and Company. Minex 64, 7 p.m. is Bang, 7:30 is Young, 8 p.m. is Chicago PD, 9 p.m. is Chicago PD, 10 p.m. is Local 12 News, 10:30 is Bang, 11 p.m. is Young, and 11:30 is Men. NBC 2, 7 p.m. is Inside Edition, 7:30 is Jeopardy, 8 p.m. is Password, 9 p.m. is Dateline, 11 p.m. is News, and 11:30 is The Tonight Show. CBS 7, 7 p.m. is Wheel, 7:30 is Entertainment Tonight, 8 p.m. is SWAT, 9 p.m. is Fire Country, 10 p.m. is Blue Bloods, 11 p.m. is News, and 11:30 is The Late Show. PBS 14, 7 p.m. is DW News, 7:30 is BBC News, 8 p.m. is Father Brown, 9 p.m. is Masterpiece, 10 p.m. is The Tunnel, Vengeance, 11 p.m. is News, 11:30 is DW News. PBS 16, 7 p.m. is The Day, 7:30 is Islands, 8 p.m. is Washington Week, 8:30 is Firing Line, 9 p.m. is Finding Your Roots, 10 p.m. is The Expressway with Dual Hill. 11 p.m. is Independent Lens. ABC 22, 7 p.m. is the 2024 NFL Draft. 11:30 is News. Fox 22.2, 7 p.m. is Bang. 7:30 is Bang. 8 p.m. is WWE Friday Night SmackDown. 10 p.m. is News. 11 p.m. is iCrime. 11:30 is Family. CW 26, 7 p.m. is Young. 7:30 is Young. 8 p.m. is Penn and Teller Fool Us. 9 p.m. is 100 Days to Indy. 10 p.m. is News. 11 p.m. is 2 News. 11 p.m. is Friends. 11:30 is Friends. Ion 43, 7 p.m. is Hawaii 5-0. 8 p.m. Hawaii 5-0. 9 p.m. Hawaii 5-0. 10 p.m. Hawaii 5-0 and 11 p.m. is Hawaii 5-0. PBS 54, 7 p.m. is the PBS News Hour. 8 p.m. is Comment. 8:30 is Washington Week. 9 p.m. is Great Performances. 10 p.m. is Art Happens Here. 11 p.m. is BBC News. 11:30 is Kentucky. And now for the obituaries for Friday, April 26th. David P. Awesome, 76, Cincinnati, Ohio, April 20th, Gilligan Funeral Home. Gertrude Brewer, 96 North Bend, Ohio, April 22nd, Dennis George Funeral Home. Victoria C. Buck, 78 Ohio, April 19th, Paul R. Young Funeral Home, Hamilton. Michael J. Connaughton, 90 Cincinnati, Ohio, April 22nd, George H. Roddy and Son. Deborah Diomtrick Herbst, 72, Dry Ridge, Kentucky, April 17th, Ellison Stanley Funeral Home. Ruth Ketchmar, 86, Cincinnati, April 21st, Voorhees and Ryan Lachlan. Mary May J. Nugent, née Panero, 98, Cincinnati, Ohio, April 20th, Radel Funeral Service Company, Delhi. Wanda L. Pendel, Cincinnati, April 24th, Newcomer Funeral Home. Roberta May Poley, 89, Beaver Creek, Ohio, Newcomer Cremations Funerals and Reception Home. Now in the USA Today section, Lifeline, Making Waves. Seals discusses Ray. Amanda Seals is opening up about her relationship with former co-star Isaac Ray. Seals, who starred with Ray on the HBO dramedy Insecure, addressed the rumored feud between the actresses during an appearance on the Club Shay Shay podcast released Wednesday. "She wasn't empowering to me," Seals says. "She didn't feel like I deserved to be protected. I'm only giving a portion of the situation, but that was my experience. And nonetheless, I have still always protected her because I felt it was my responsibility to do so, but it is not." Now in birthdays, if you're celebrating today, you're celebrating today with Channing Tatum, who's 44, Carol Burnett is 91, and Giancarlo Esposito is 66. Now in horoscopes, Sanctuary, Aries, March 21st to April 19th. After processing your enthusiasm to expand your horizons, what new adventure awaits? Envision your journey. Taurus, April 20th to May 20th. Uncovering hidden truths, look inward today. Examine the philosophies that guide you. Gemini, May 21st to June 21st. Exploring relationship options. There's a dualistic need for closeness and freedom. Entertain the best of both worlds. Cancer, June 22nd to July 22nd. Have pep in your step? The day looks brighter than usual. Soak up the good vibes. Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd. Fun is calling. Burn off emotional residue by embracing your inner child. Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd. Recoup for intense busyness. Feel like staying in? A day at home revitalizes your emotional energy. Libra, September 23rd to October 23rd. Go on a journey of the mind. Have a new book you're enthusiastic to read. Dive into another world. Scorpio, October 24th to November 21st. On a quest for abundance, you are filled with energy to grow your material resources. Collect your ideas. Sagittarius, November 22nd to April to December 21st. The universe lights your fire. Feel worlds apart from where you were just yesterday. Thank the Sagittarius moon for that. Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th. Adventure into your inner world today. Ready to explore your spiritual side? Revelations await. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th. Gather amongst your people. A fire lights under your social life. Get in on the action. Pisces, February 19th to March 20th. A surge of ambition runs through your veins. Willing to take professional leaps, the moon presents existing growth opportunities. Now in streaming, Truth About Netflix's Stalker Story, Baby Reindeer, by Kelly Lauer, USA Today. Santa has nothing to do with this reindeer. There's a new Netflix series atop the streamer's most watched chart that you might have heard about from disturbed fans, friends, and family. In the 2 weeks since it premiered on the platform, Baby Reindeer, a heavy series in which a bartender and wannabe comedian, Richard Gadd, is stalked by a middle-aged woman, has become a sensation. Darkly captivating all on its own, fans are even more engrossed when they learn the series is based on the true story of stalking and abuse suffered by Gadd, who is also the series' creator. So why is the deeply disquieting series suddenly so popular? And how much of the story is really true? We answer all your questions about Baby Reindeer. What is Baby Reindeer about? In just 7 short episodes, Reindeer is both horrifying and fascinating. It tells the story of Donnie, a fictionalized version of Gadd, who serves Martha, Jessica Gunning, a free cup of tea, unknowingly starting a years-long odyssey that begins with thousands of harassing emails and gets worse from there. As the series progresses, Martha becomes some unhinged and violent, turning her anger on Donnie's friends, girlfriend, and family. Baby Reindeer is one of the many nicknames Martha gives the object of her obsession. Amid the harassment and trauma, Donnie reflects on past abuses he suffered that he believes made him a sticking plaster for a predator like Martha. In a flashback episode, he tells the story of Darian, Tom Goodman Hill, a much older comedian and writer who groomed and abused Donnie over the course of many months. Darian promised to help Donnie's career, then fed the younger man drugs and sexually assaulted him while Donnie was unconscious. Donnie's experiences with Darian left him traumatized and hollow, ruining his relationship with girlfriend Keely, Shalman Brune Franklin. He becomes sexually confused, threatening a new courtship with Terry, Nava Mao, a transgender woman Donnie is secretly ashamed to date. Martha's stalking, of course, does not help his relationship with Terry either. Is Baby Reindeer a true story? Yes, Reindeer is Gadd's memoir writ large. The series incorporates 2 large shows by the comedian, each about a trauma he suffered. The original Reindeer began as a one-man show about Gadd's stalker at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 2019 and later became an Olivia-winning play on London's West End. Before that, Gadd started in his 2016 play, Monkey See, Monkey Do, another one-man show about the sexual violence and abuse he experienced, which he performed running on a treadmill pursued by a gorilla. Although Martha and Darian are heavily fictionalized, fans have been investigating online to try to uncover their real identities, going so far as to accuse figures in British comedy of being Darian. Gadd has condemned this type of amateur sleuthing. People I love, have worked with, and admire are unfairly getting caught up in speculation, he wrote in an Instagram story on April 22nd. Please don't speculate on who any of the real people could be. That's not the point of our show. Is Baby Reindeer any good? Reindeer is good in the sense that it is impeccably crafted. Gadd wrote his story with substantial nuance. Martha is no crackling dizzy villain, and Donnie is no innocent lamb. The characters are real and raw rather than likable and perfect. The action is top-notch, particularly for Gunning, who disappears into Martha's creepy skin. The stalker isn't romanticized or sexed up, but instead portrayed as mentally ill and deeply pitiful. Reindeer is also emotional and invulnerable, the real story of some of the most horrific traumas anyone can experience. It is unsettling and terrifying and nearly impossible to look away from. Though well made, it is not for everyone. The flashback episode is likely to prove triggering for the intensely graphic depictions of Darian's assaults on Donnie. It is the kind of on-screen violence that sits with you long after the credits have rolled. Gadd says he wanted to capture the complexity of his own story without creating a victim narrative, In an interview with Netflix's fan website, Tudum, he says, I think art is quite interesting when you don't know who you are on the side of. I wanted it to be layered, and I wanted to capture the human experience. The human experience is that people are good, but they have bits of bad, and they make mistakes. The comedian has certainly captured his own very human experience, and you probably won't feel the same after you see it. In movies, Zendaya says it was kind of scary making Challengers. In Zendaya's erotic Challengers, tennis is the new sex. The movie, in theaters Friday, follows a messy love triangle between bright young tennis stars, all chasing a very specific kind of high, that rare moment when two players fully lock into the game, entwined in a romantic tango of sorts on the court. It's an intoxicating feeling described by her Wonderkin character, Tashi Duncan. But while making the movie, Zendaya never reached such nirvana. I never got that good, she humbly says with a laugh, speaking by phone earlier this week. Since filming wrapped in 2022, I haven't really picked up a racket. I went once just to hit a few balls and see if I could still do it. And you know what? I wasn't too bad. I thought it would have all just gone out the window, but there is a little something there. Tashi may appear very strong, but character more complex. Taking place over 13 years, Challengers tracks Tashi as she falls in and out of relationships with Patrick, Josh O'Connor, and Art, Mike Feist, best friends competing for her attention on and off the court. The sweaty, sultry film has made headlines for its three-way kiss and so-called villain Tashi, a tennis prodigy who turns to coaching after she's sidelined by a career-ending injury in college. The character is a world-class manipulator and motivator as she pits the red-blooded, well-to-do guys against each other. But her passion for tennis, the insatiable desire to win, stems from her modest background. For Tashi, there's no other thing to fall back on, Zendaya says. Her parents can't afford what the boys can. There's not that luxury of just knowing you're going to be all right either way. Also, she's never given herself a moment to grieve the effects the injury has had on her life. She immediately just sucks it up and moves on, and I think that's an experience a lot of women feel, and a lot of black women as well. Not having the time or the space to just feel and having to present to the world a very strong all the time. Zendaya, 27, was already attached to the project when producer Amy Pascal sent the script to director Luca Guadagnino, Call Me By Your Name, who is drawn to this idea of the game of love and eroticism portrayed through the game of tennis, he says. The Italian filmmaker has been long fascinated by Zendaya's career, from her start on Disney Channel's Shake It Up to her two-time Emmy-winning role on HBO's Euphoria. He likens her to an old Hollywood star whose sheer personality and power can command the gaze of millions of people. She has a natural gift combined with a sense of gracefulness, and hard work. She's a producer on Challengers, too, which added a level of fun, Guadagnino says. Zendaya has this curiosity and commitment to the art of filmmaking. She's invested in the process beyond merely acting in it. Zendaya, who has roughly a decade of producing credits under her belt, says she felt free to suggest and bring in ideas. I got lucky that Luca is extremely collaborative, so whether I had a producer title or not, he would be open to working together. You don't always get that. For the actress, it's also about championing original stories. And at the time where non-franchise films struggle to break through, that aren't named Barbie or Oppenheimer. The R-rated mid-budget Challengers come from first-time screenwriter Justin Guiztakes, husband of Past Lives director Celine Song, and it's a test of Denzea's star power after her appearances in Dune and Spider-Man film series. You need to make more movies like this, Zendaya says. It's kind of scary because this is an original screenplay, and those can be difficult to get people out to see. I hope that we can continue to have more variety in Hollywood and get people engaged with different kinds of films. Though her red carpet looks, Zendaya plays wants to pay tribute to black sports icons. Challengers has already drawn feverishly attention on its fashion, from Tashi's Sapphire Party to dress to her I Told You slogan tee, inspired by the shirt John F. Kennedy Jr. wore in the 1990s. Although Zendaya herself is a style icon, she gives full credit to the movie's costume designer, Jonathan Anderson. These characters are entwined through clothes, Zendaya says. There's a lot of t-shirts that start with me and end with Josh's character, or the boys share t-shirts sometimes. There's this ever-present thing of them being connected while they are the other person. Zendaya and her longtime stylist, Law Roach, have always loved telling stories through fashion, with jaw-dropping looks that frequently reflect her current projects. Promoting Challengers, the dynamic duo has been leaning into so-called tennis score, polo dresses, neutral colors, and stilettos spiked through tennis balls. We've been having a lot of fun with tennis looks, Zendaya says, but it's important to us, and there's a storytelling element, that it doesn't just feel like glitz and glamour the whole time. So we decided to pay tribute to iconic figures. Last week, she and Roach recreated a 1998 Vogue shoot by tennis legends Venus and Serena Williams, in which she wears a near-identical black-and-white gown with beaded braids. Afterward, Law got a nice message from Venus, Zendaya says. They also collaborated with sports brand On for a replica of tennis whites worn by Althea Gibson, the first black player to compete at Wimbledon in 1951. That was a special look, just paying homage to her work as a black woman, Zendaya says. And then obviously, Venus and Serena have been massive inspirations, just to me in life. Law has seen that Vogue image and was like, we should recreate that. We just did it in our hotel room, but it felt like a special thing. Has been so supportive of the film. In streaming, Gear adds theme to 1970s Foxy Brown by Brian Truitt, USA Today. Usually, the only intruders Pam Grier has to worry about are the horses who saunter into her Colorado ranch house uninvited. I've got to get them out before they poop, says the longtime actress and 1970s film icon. They feel comfortable walking in and going to sleep. Hey, Mom, how you doing? In a new horror series, Greer, 74, faces some far more supernatural themes to scare, now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Centers on Dawn, Deborah Everindi, an LAPD homicide detective in the 1991 aftermath of the Rodney King beating, pursuing a serial killer who leaves gruesome crime scenes. Greer plays Dawn's mom, Athena, who takes care of her daughter and grandson, Joshua J. Williams, harbors a dark secret and has terrifying visions, including a monstrous washing machine, around the house that may or may not be real. This is not the sex symbol of old, says Greer, who gained fame in the blaxploitation era and became a pop culture powerhouse with films like 1974's Foxy Brown. Now I know what it takes to take care of people who can no longer take care of themselves anymore and are ashamed, and give up that strength to vulnerability. Theme, them, the scare adds to Greer's horror resume. Greer has a history of scary projects, dating back to 1973's Scream Bakula Scream, which includes the 2001 Snoop Dogg movie Bones and last year's Pet Sematary Bloodlines. Not everyone can handle horror. They don't like to be scared, she says. I don't like going into a dark room that I've never been into. What scares Greer most? Using ancestry sites like 23andMe. Oh, I have 99 cousins. Great. For the second season of his anthology series, Them, creator Little Marvin sought out Greer to play Athena. When I read the script the first time, I'm scared. My hands are sweating. Whoa. Now I know why folks drink, she recalls. He felt I wasn't numb from all the events in my life that could make people run into a padded room, never come out to be weighted with medication. But Greer pulled it off by bringing her real self into the role. So much that it involved crying, anxiety, and nosebleeds. I'm not layers of calluses on my emotions. I'm raw. I'm still there. It made me feel, yeah, I haven't given up. Iconic 1990 actress calls Colorado, not Hollywood, home. In 1991, when Scare is set, Greer wasn't living in lavish L.A. Instead, she called Colorado home, taking care of her family, and she still loves that lifestyle. I have trucks. I have dirt. I could name 10 tractor companies, she says. I don't roll out of bed and get to go to work. I come from a long distance of really enjoying what I'm doing. I step off the plane. I walk into the office in character. But the LAPD of the past is well-informed and very dangerous, she says. In the late 90s, Greer was starring in the Showtime comedy Lynx, and stayed in L.A. for 9 months while filming on Paramount lot. She left work one morning at 4 a.m. and was stopped by an officer on Melrose Avenue, told to get out of her car, and interrogated about what she was doing at that time of day. They didn't believe me. And if I made a false move, I probably would not be here, Greer recalls. I never late for work, but I wanted to survive. That scared me. And if it's happening to me, a woman with rollers in her hair going to work at 4 a.m., then a whole lot of folks are going through something. Greer celebrates 50 years of Foxy Brown. Greer recently optioned her 2010 memoir, Foxy, My Life in Three Acts, and her life story is being developed as a TV series with Village Roadshow Pictures. One of the aspects it will touch on is the origins of Foxy Brown, which celebrated its 50th anniversary on April 5th. Foxy, a woman who poses as a prostitute to infiltrate a criminal syndicate after her undercover agent boyfriend is murdered, has been a touchstone for decades. But in action films like Foxy and Coffee a year earlier, she surprised people as an up-and-coming actress who spent her childhood in Colorado and Wyoming hunting, fishing, and studying karate and aikido. I took 3 or 4 years to prepare a patriarchal society to see a woman in a man's position. Traditional martial arts, leadership, standing up, talking back, Greer says. She also admits that she got a lot of my foxiness from the women around her, especially her aunt. I was just doing what they were thinking. I didn't create the wheel. As a kid, I was a dork and skinny. My kneecaps were bigger than my legs. I wasn't attractive. I didn't attract boys or anything. So in her early 20s, when she cast in Foxy, her first thought was, I don't think they're going to watch. And lo and behold, they did watch for 50 years. Now in music, Swift's All the Racist Lyric Dividing Listeners by Jay Stahl, USA Today. Taylor Swift's controversial song, I Hate It Here, has fans divided about the pop star's racial lens and lyricism. My friends used to play a game where we would pick a decade we wish we could live in instead of this one. I'd say the 1830s, but without all the racists and getting married off to the highest bid, Swift sings. The track from the Tortured Poets Department, the anthology, a deluxe version of her album that features 31 songs, is about her discontent and the way our recollections are distorted by nostalgia. It also marks the first time that Swift has sung about race in her music. While Swift has opened up about political topics such as voting rights and LGBTQ plus issues during her nearly 20-year career, she has rarely spoken or sang about the subject of race. The only exception was in 2020, following the murder of George Floyd by police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. At that time, she posted on her Instagram and Twitter 2 weeks after Floyd's death, with resources, called out former President Donald Trump for stoking the fires of white supremacy his entire presidency, and chided her home state of Tennessee for monuments that celebrate racist historical figures who did evil things. Now experts, critics, and fans are analyzing the reactions and swift backlash to Swift's I Hate It Here. Excerpt, music may face disconnect with certain demographics. Professor Naomi Ickes teaches a course about the connection between psychology and Swift's place in pop culture at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas. She believes there are universal themes listeners have experienced in Swift's lyrics, but notes that the pop star's particular worldwide view may not translate to everyone. At the beginning of the spring semester, Ickes asked her students what labels they attached to Swift. Many of the responses reflected they were all white girl experiences, and this is a white girl music, and this isn't the kind of that representation or that connection kind of outside of that particular racial group, she tells USA Today. Anyone's dated the bad boy and they've had their friendship breakups and they've, you know, crashed and burned in relationships. Revenge, these are petty women themes across humankind. But then her particular life is how she's living them out, not connect to everybody, Ika says. She is that has someone who is white and who likes to listen to Swift music. That perspective didn't cross her mind at first. But as she listened to the music more and spoke with people from differing backgrounds, she understands the viewpoint. Swift fans' relationship plays out on TikTok. I'm concerned. Swifties, fans of the Pennsylvania-born pop star, are famously defensive of Swift's music and her motives. Claire Aduwu, a black psychiatry student and self-proclaimed Taylor Swift fan, posted a video on TikTok with a caption that read, "I'm a Swiftie, but this album is a flop." Aduwu says people are reacting to the lyric based on our own personal experiences that we're putting on a lyric, telling USA Today that Swifties are identifying the lyrics in a good way, while people who are black may be identifying the lyrics in a bad way. Dozens of fellow Swifties criticized the take in the comments of Aduko's original TikTok. She followed up with a response video about parasocial relationships, or what Cleveland Clinic refers to as one-sided relationships with celebrities or fictional characters. Aduwu, who attended the Eras Tour last year as Swift's previous Red Tour, also said she is reconsidering if she is a Swiftie after the TikTok backlash she received. As a black fan, Aduwu knows Swift is obviously this is a white woman who caters to a certain demographic of people compared to some other artists going to the concert clearly. You can see how diverse that was compared to maybe a Beyoncé crowd, and so you're already kind of feeling odd in that situation. I just think maybe some fans of color feel a bit isolated that this lyric kind of plays into the rose-colored glasses people sometimes have towards the past of this whimsical Bridgerton, like existence where black people aren't in that picture. She added, not even just that people are racist or not, but black people are just not included in the picture of that society. Some Swift fans say I Hate It Here is self-critique commentary. Some believe that Swift's lyricism in I Hate It Here is a simple line with complicated undertones and commentary. Stephanie Burt, a literary critic and professor at Harvard University, who teaches a buzzy course on Swift and offers a deeper analysis of Swift's lyricism, argues that Swift is critiquing herself and looking back on a series of illusions and delusions that have captured her psychology. She goes on the same verse to say, "Wow, that was silly." She ends up criticizing herself, which she is honestly doing a lot on this album. She ends up framing her own folly and inviting us to see her making bad judgments and oversimplifying her own history and world history, Burt says. She is calling herself out for the same kind of extraordinary, common, fake nostalgia and, as she says, quill pen writing. The people taking her out of context on Twitter are calling her out for. And as usual, she says harsher things about herself than her critics do. And she's right. She knows exactly what she's doing, Burt says. Burt says she believes Swift doesn't address race or white supremacy in her music because she doesn't have a lot to say as an artist about it. But I think she's aware of it. I think she's leaving it to Josh Isbell, a white dude who does write songs critical of white supremacy. For all we know, she has 10 songs about fighting white privilege somewhere in her catalog, and she didn't release them because she didn't think they were very good, Burt says. C.T. Liotta, an author and Substack columnist who has written about Swift and his own nostalgia, compared it, I Hate It Here, to Swift's LGBTQ+ anthem, You Need to Calm Down, which was released in 2019. The curious thing about I Hate It Here is that I don't feel it addresses race much at all, or in any substantive way. It isn't like You Need to Calm Down, which is a clear rebuke to LGBTQ hate. In fact, it may even be thoughtful for her to acknowledge that the 1830s were filled with racism, rather than leaving it at I'd Like to Visit, Loita writes in an email interview. Swift has previously changed one of her controversial lyrics on the 2010 track Better Than Revenge with a re-release of her Speak Now album last year. In the original, she sings, she better known for her things than she does on a mattress. In Better Than Revenge, Taylor versions, a line rewritten for 2023, she says, he was a moth to the flame, she was holding the matches. Is I Hate It Here backlash typical for Swift? The United States and the world has long been divided over the pop superstardom of Swift. I Hate It Here is the latest chapter in the tortured poet's personal controversies. People have taken sides during Swift's long-running feud with rapper Ye, formerly known as Kanye West, and his ex-wife Kim Kardashian. Swift has spoken at length about misogyny, gender politics, and the effect of shame on her health. When people fall out of love with you, there's nothing you can do to make them change their minds, Swift says herself in Miss Americana, the 2020 documentary from Netflix, which details her complex relationship with fame. Liotta believes she's right. None of that matters to Swifties because they haven't fallen out of love with her. One of the most curious things to note is how this tempest is a teapot will do nothing to harm Taylor Swift's brand. I can't think of a single person who has so far said, I was a fan of Taylor Swift until she released I Hate It Here. Her core audience simply doesn't care about this. Who does? People who haven't liked her for years, Liotta says. Eckes also questions the criticism and backlashings surrounding I Hate It Here. If we think back to like this attacking on the lyrics and everything, we would be doing the same thing to a man? I don't know. Would we be tearing apart Kane's lyrics like this? I feel like the only lyrics we've ever torn apart of Kane's were the ones that he wrote about Taylor Swift. Right. Now in streaming, Bon Jovi doc, Honest About Band Sambori, by Melissa Ruggieri, USA Today. After 40 years, 130 million albums sold, thousands of stadiums filled, and many a musical fad dodged, Bon Jovi is still standing. The anchors of some rock's most durable anthems, You Give Love a Bad Name, Bad Medicine, It's My Life, Living on a Prayer, Wanted Dead or Alive, as well as a new entry, legendary from the band's upcoming Forever album, long ago achieved icon status. Bon Jovi's history, from playing grimy clubs on the Jersey Shore to the zenith in the 80s, to decades more of musical stylistic experimentation and sold-out tours, is presented with unflinching honesty and Thank You, Goodnight, the Bon Jovi story. The four-episode documentary, totaling nearly 5 hours, debuts Friday on Hulu. Directed by Gautam Chopra, Man in the Arena, Tom Brady, Greatness Code, the film traverses the era of ripped jean shorts and the frosted tip mame sported by John Bon Jovi in his 20s to the agonizing vocal issues and gray shag that arrived in middle age. Along with John Bon Jovi, 62, fellow original members drummer Tico Torres and keyboardist David Byron chime in frequently, as does guitarist Richie Sambori, who abruptly departed Bon Jovi in 2013 and finally offers somewhat of an explanation. The band's original bassist, Alec John Souk, who left the group in 1994 and died in June 2022, is eulogized. In a recent video chat, John Bon Jovi, casual in a black t-shirt and sipping from a white mug, expounded on some key elements of the film, including his decades-long friendship with Bruce Springsteen, watching the documentary with Sambora, and the mental anguish he endured while working through his vocal cord problems. Question: legacy and mortality are the central themes in this documentary. So have you emerged from the process feeling relieved that everything is out there, or sad that aging stops for no one? Answer: it's becoming therapeutic because I'm speaking about it for the first time, and it's been a two-year project. There is that old story that you see your life flash before you when you pass, and if I've had the benefit of having my life flash before me and not passed away, I'm happy we did it. The documentary is the first time we heard about the surgery you had in 2022 trying to repair your vocal cords. How does your voice sound to you now? It's a work in progress. I had a fantastic surgeon in Philadelphia, and I sang his praise because he never misled me in the process. He says I'm going to do what's called a medialization. There will be a Gore-Tex implant put in the front of your throat. We'll try to strengthen the cords and get them back to being more subtle so you can be better than you currently are. It's been a process for 22 months, and every day I work at it. At this juncture, as people are seeing the film, they think I was in the film. I'm much further along. What do you think people will be most surprised about? In the big picture, it was my desire to show the whole truth and nothing but the truth. With all of the blemishes of life is, not only in the band, but as a member of a team and family. There are little victories and big defeats along the way, and it wasn't going to be a puff piece. I wasn't interested in creating a 40-year-old vanity piece. I've been at this for a long time. My hair went gray, and that's not a needle in my face. I also think people might be surprised to find out how far back your relationship goes with Bruce Springsteen. Obviously, Bruce is from Mount Rushmore, is the Mount Rushmore of rock and roll, and the king of rock and roll in New Jersey. Look, the E Street Band and Southside Johnny and the Ashbury Jukes made the impossible seem possible. You were going to run into them in a bar, which is important because the posters on the wall of Led Zeppelin and Queen and Mott the Hopple, you weren't going to meet those guys on the Jersey Shore. And now you've given up the secret for your long drives with Bruce in New Jersey. We were neighbors. Our kids went to school together. We spent a lot of private time together, but didn't need to tell the world. As we've grown older, I'm vocal about it because I didn't feel the need to hide something that was true. I've just known the guy for 45 years, and he happens to be like a big brother. Fans will be interested to hear from Richie and his reasons for leaving the band. Was it difficult to get him involved in participating? No, he was an integral part of the past 30 years of the band. He and I watched the first 3 episodes together in August. What do you think about his comments about why he left? Everybody has their own truths, and watching the film together on that night was not uncomfortable for me. He came to my home in New Jersey to watch it. Seeing him in it, it's hard to comprehend that 11 years ago he quit and never came to see us or have a conversation about it. Whether it was substance abuse or anxiety or single parenting, there were a lot of things that led to it. One thing the public has to understand is that there was no fight, there were no animus. Being in a rock band is not a life sentence, because Richie chose not to come anymore. It broke a lot of hearts, but there's no way the band was not going to continue. Though Alec left Bon Jovi in 1994, I think fans will be touched to see how you honor his memory. Did he know the documentary was in the works? We had just started it when he died. We'd seen him in 2018 at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, which was wonderful. He was very well spoken and he played well when he joined us for a song. He was really at peace. When he left the band, he jokingly said, "If I can't be in Bon Jovi or the Rolling Stones, I'm quitting the business." So I respected that, and he stuck to that. He didn't write a tell-all or join some band to try to capitalize on time with us. He was very, very grateful for his time with us and what we were with him. What do you think future touring looks like? Would you consider doing something like the Spear in Vegas? I was gassed, having been opening night of U2. Could we consider that as a tour? I thought the Spear was otherworldly. I loved it. But at this time, this isn't an option for me. I love being there. But the desert is not my friend, and creating the context of the X Factor or how many shows you can or you should do. Plus, we don't live on the West Coast. There's no going home on days off. None of it would make sense. You end a documentary by saying, "If I can't do it at 100%, then thank you and good night." We're not at that point yet, are we? It was a year ago in the episode when I was trying to sing "I Wrote You a Song" from the upcoming Forever album, and it wasn't working well. To be clear, I'm very capable of singing again, but the bar needs to be 2.5 hours, 4 nights a week before I'm considered touring. If there's any uncertainty with the instrument, truthfully, I'm not going to do it. I will not compromise the legacy or the joy. I can no longer put myself through the mental torture of having a deficiency that was not of my own doing. You can only imagine the mental anguish of going, "Why isn't it working? How do I compensate?" You saw me perform at Music Cares in February, and I think I sang very well. When I woke up the next morning, it was the first time in 10 years I woke up without other voices in my head. There was no doubt, there was no fear, progress is coming. In the big picture, it was my desire to show the whole truth and nothing but the truth, but all the blemishes of what is life. Jon Bon Jovi. Now also from USA Today, Bears unveil $5 billion proposal for a new domed lakefront stadium. Chicago. The Bears unveiled a nearly $5 billion $5 proposal Wednesday for an enclosed stadium next door to their current home at Soldier Field as part of a major project that would transform the city's lakefront. They are asking for public funding to help make it happen. The plan calls for $3.2 billion for the new stadium, plus an additional $1.5 billion in infrastructure. The team in the city said the project would add green and open space while improving access to city's museum campus, and also could include a publicly owned hotel. This is not an easy project, but Chicago doesn't like it easy, Bears President Kevin Warren said. The announcement at Soldier Field comes during the busy week for the Bears. They are expected to take 2022 Heisman Trophy winner Caleb Williams with the number one pick in the draft Thursday night and bank on the USC quarterback to solidify a position that has long been a sore spot for the founding NFL franchise. The team said last month it was prepared to provide more than $2 billion in funding toward the publicly owned stadium in the city. The proposal calls for $2.025 billion from the Bears, $300 million from the NFL loan, and $900 million in bonds from the Illinois Sports Facilities Authority. The funding from the ISFA would involve extending bonds of the existing 2% hotel tax. The Bears said the project would generate $8 billion in economic impact for the region. It will be built in three phases, and construction would take up to 5 years. The new stadium would be constructed on a parking lot just south of Soldier Field, the Bears' home since 1971. The team's lease at the 100-year-old stadium runs through 2033. Mayor Brandon Johnson gave a full-throated endorsement, saying the project is in line with Daniel Burnham's 1999 plan of Chicago. Johnson said there would be no tax hikes or new taxes for Chicago residents. And this is Ed Murphy signing off for Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired.